from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a sore point for a long time. Women as trifles, as sex objects, as second-tier players in Hollywood. It's still a sore point. Just listen anytime Hollywood women get together. But are there signs of something else, something new? Maybe this summer. This hour, On Point, Women in Hollywood on both sides of the camera, and the summer of 2014. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Women, what do you see or not see in the movies of Hollywood and the people who make them? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Anne Hornaday, Washington Post film critic. Her latest critic's notebook is headlined, The Sisters of Summer. Anne Hornaday, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And from New York, Wesley Morris joins us, film critic for Grantland. He won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 2011 for his work at the Boston Globe. His latest headline here, I'm looking at summer movie preview, Same Dudes, More Women. Wesley Morris, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Wesley.
It's great to have you both with us. We're going to hear from a couple of women directors before we finish up this hour. But, Anne, what are you pointing to as a sign of maybe a change in the wind?
Yeah, the emphasis on maybe. Tom, I had written a column a few weeks back sort of about the dearth of women, especially behind the camera, and the kind of monoculture that we've been swimming in, at least cinematically, in terms of the stories that are told and the pool that they come from. And lo and behold, about a week or two later, I had Maleficent to write about, and then I had this movie, The Fault in Our Stars, to write about that was top-lined by a young actress named Shailene Woodley that did extremely well at the box office, driven by young women audiences, and then this really extraordinary indie romantic comedy called Obvious Child that centers around a young woman coping with an unplanned pregnancy and choosing to terminate that pregnancy and really portraying the issue of choice, reproductive choice, and autonomy in a really new, honest, frank way. And so I just thought that I wanted to write about that. It was more like a snapshot in time. I mean, I don't want to make any great claims that this is the turning point summer, but I just sort of, I wanted to pay attention to that. And also, I want to also mention a movie called Edge of Tomorrow, this poor little movie starring a guy named Tom Cruise that got sort of overshadowed by Fault in Our Stars, which has at its core a really sort of enlightened, progressive-minded relationship between the male protagonist and the very strong female heroine played by Emily Blunt, which I thought also boded well and was sort of encouraging. So that was just, it was like I said, a snapshot that I sort of wanted to recognize and acknowledge.
We'll hear a little bit from Emily Blunt in just a minute. I mean, Wesley, you were picking up on something here as well. This may have been a little earlier, but you were looking out across. You wrote 17 of the 40 major or majorish studio movies scheduled for release between May and Labor Day, your definition of summer, star a woman or prominently feature women in an ensemble. You wrote there, Wesley, already in April, in 2014, the air of womanliness is strong. Where do you see it? Where do you pick it up?
Well, I mean, just looking at the numbers, I wanted, it's easy to sort of go into these previews not having seen the movies and just speculating about their quality. But I feel, I mean, I don't enjoy doing those, but I feel are necessary to have some sort of salvo for how I plan to spend the next 4 months, what I would find interesting to look for. And this summer, for some reason, I just noticed there were more movies with women protagonists starring them. And, I mean, I might have joked about this in the piece I wrote, but it's important that a lot of those movies have the names of the women in the title. Like Maleficent can only be about one person. There's a movie called Jupiter Rising with Mila Kunis by the Wachowskis that is about a woman named Jupiter. I mean, these are superficial things, but they also mean that the agency and the point of view, hopefully, will be with the perspective of the woman. And this in summer is not unprecedented, but the number, it's almost half of the movies, of these biggest and big movies, are fronted by women. And I think that's a change. And as Anne said, I mean, there is sort of a, it's preliminary. There's some caution around that. And the question is it sustainable and will it continue? And you know how these things are. We're still talking about the Bridesmaids effect. And right. What lessons the movies and the executives in Hollywood have learned from the success of that movie.
I wonder
exactly.
I
just want to add, just a few minutes ago, one of my colleagues, Emily Yar, posted a very smart blog post that traditionally, and this goes for African-American-centered films as well, they're always called, quote-unquote, surprise hits. Like, we're going to see one this weekend with Think Like a Man 2. I mean, Think Like a Man, which features a mostly African-American cast, was considered a, quote-unquote, surprise hit a couple of years ago. And it's like, when are they going to stop being surprised already?
Surprise! There are black people with money to go to the movies.
Exactly.
And a lot of them are women.
And women are half the audience.
I'm trying to figure out exactly what counts here in terms of moving the needle. Here's just a little bit from Maleficent. This is the retelling of the 1959 Sleeping Beauty from the perspective of the villain, played here by Angelina Jolie. Here she is crashing the christening of the new Princess Aurora, talking to the King Stefan, played by Charlton Copley.
I must say, I really felt quite distressed at not receiving an invitation.
You're not welcome here.
Oh dear. What an awkward situation.
Angelina Jolie taking that giggle from the frothy to the menacing. And what are you seeing here? Is it in the story? Is it in the fact that the name of the female is in the title? Is it in the way Jolie plays? If you're counting this in the category of cracking the monoculture a little bit, what's the crack?
Well, I think the way it's a totally revisionist take on the story, and I would argue a feminist revisionist take on the story. And I know that millions of people have already seen it, but I'm always loath to commit spoilers. But the way that the filmmakers have kind of twisted the story to really focus around Maleficent's relationship with Aurora, and it just becomes a very female-centric and kind of a healing narrative in terms of their relationship. But it also has everything to do with Angelina Jolie's persona that she so brilliantly harmonizes, with roles at her very best. And this one kind of plays on what we know about her off-screen life as a mother, as a loving, by all intents and purposes, loving mother. And one of her children even shows up in a cameo with her kind of saying, "I don't like children," which everyone knows is just hilariously, not true. So it does kind of, it plays with that as well. But I think I think what I consider the most sort of progressive about it is the way that it kind of tweaks that storyline.
A feminist story in Maleficent. Wesley, do you see it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely timely. I think it's definitely on to something, and it's speaking to a larger narrative within movies and sort of in beyond them, too. The thing that Anne doesn't want to spoil is a kind of shocking thing to have in a movie like this, because it's filmed and enacted as a real violation. And the movie, the gist of the movie sort of springs from there. Mm. And that's where the source of the revision comes from. And that's a really audacious thing to have at the center of a movie that is making a lot of money. And to have it fronted by this very big movie star who, it should be noted, does not work very often. And so when she does, there is a lot of pressure both on her as a brand and excitement, pressure on her as a brand and pressure on this, on her being a woman in a movie, fronting a movie. And I'm just happy to, I don't think the movie's that great. I think she, Angelina Jolie, is incredible. And I think there, I'd like to give credit to Linda Wolverton, Wolverton, who wrote the script. She's been in the Disney family for a long time, and it's kind of a mess. But I think that the politics at the center of this movie are really fascinating and daring to get into a summer movie, especially given its seeming innocent source material.
Not to give it away, but there's a kind of symbolic rape in here. Talk about dealing with feminist issues. I mean, I don't think that it's not a rape, but symbolically, and the coming to terms with that, that's about as down to the non-male monoculture as you can get, Anne.
Absolutely. And I think that what that, as Wesley said, I mean, that is the pivot point. And then it kind of turns into this parable of female solidarity and maternal protection. And I kept sort of envisioning, you know, I haven't actually looked at the demographics of the audience, but I'm envisioning mothers taking their daughters. You know, I mean, it's this is a very sort of female driven, you know, the family market. Mm-hmm. And women do make those decisions about what movies you're going to go see. And I just think that's an incredibly powerful moment for any mother and her young daughter to go through that journey together with, as Wesley said, I agree. I don't think the movie's great itself, but Jolie is just at her most magnificent. So I think it can be a really powerful experience.
I mean, just to pick up what Anne was saying, the thing that's more shocking in this movie, actually, and this is a shocking thing to feel, but I was really shocked by how much a movie about womanly solidarity Maleficent is. You know, in some ways it's really blatant and it's shooting fish in a barrel by making the villain this king and having him be a man, and his crime really is a crime of sort of stereotypical maleness. But just having this diversity of types of women sort of unified against him is a pretty incredible thing.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women, power, and female presence in Hollywood. And in the movies, they've been second fiddle for a long time. Wondering, is that changing? A little bit. Maybe right now, in the summer of 2014. Anne Hornaday is with us from the Washington Post. Her Critics Notebook headline, The Sisters of Summer. She joins us from Washington. Wesley Morris is with us from New York, film critic for Grantland. His headline, same dudes, a lot more women. One of the biggest movies this summer, The Fault in Our Stars, starring Shailene Woodley as Hazel Grace Lancaster, teenage cancer patient who is smart, thoughtful, and funny. Here's a bit.
I believe we have a choice in this world about how to tell sad stories. On the one hand, you can sugarcoat it. How nothing is too messed up that can't be fixed with a Peter Gabriel song. I like that version as much as the next girl does. It's just not the truth. This is the truth. Doctor's appointments, reality shows, worst of all, support group.
There, Shailene Woodley from The Fault in Our Stars. And if there's some feminist solidarity in Maleficent, what is it that you see in The Fault in Our Stars? I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard people describe it as, you know, love story updated decades later. Is that a step for women?
Well, I think it does sort of fulfill that traditional role that I think is a respectable one for movies, which is that are geared toward younger people, that sort of let them symbolically grapple with issues that they're starting to grapple with, like sex and death and mortality and commitment. I mean, it's a certain kind of form of cinematic storytelling that it's, when you're grown up, it's sort of easy to poo-poo as sentimental or hackneyed or any number of words you can use to describe it. But I do think that it's, like I said, it's a respectable form, and it's playing a really useful cathartic role for its core audience. In this case, I think what's feminist about it is that it's female driven. She's very much the protagonist, and as you just heard, the narrator. It's her voice, it's her gaze that we're seeing the film through. And then, like Edge of Tomorrow, it features this really enlightened young man who is just a terrific sort of partner and friend to her, which I think, again, models really well to its core audience of young women. I just think it's a really healthy modeling agent for relationships.
And you mentioned Edge of Tomorrow. People are going to think of Tom Cruise there. But Emily Blunt plays Rita in that film, famous alien fighting soldier in the action film, who tutors Tom Cruise. Here she's talking, not in the film, but in a promotional video about how tough her female character is.
I was drawn to playing someone as tough and badass and physical and dangerous as Rita. Trying to capture the choreography and the sheer violence at which she fights was the challenge. Her fight style is very aerial-based, lots of sliding under tentacles, jumping, flipping over them, slicing as she's in the air. We wanted it to look violent, but yet there was a kind of beauty to it.
Violence with a kind of beauty. Wesley, is this progress here? Tom Cruise has got the lead role, but Emily Blunt's right there. Badass.
I will say this about Edge of Tomorrow.
Okay, and only this.
It's a Tom Cruise movie from top to bottom, but what you have, the difference that this makes, and Emily Blunt is the difference, is that she is one of the few women to actually try and mostly succeed, courtesy of a smart script, to undermine Tom Cruise's Tom Cruise-ness. And she is as much a part of the basic gist of the movie is he is in a sort of time warp in this future apocalypse alien invasion, and he has to relive the same day over and over again. She has had a similar experience and can help him get to a point. It's kind of like a video game. He keeps dying in order to reset to get farther and farther into the world. And she's the person who can best help him, Tom Cruise the jerk, become Tom Cruise, the Tom Cruise we all know and love.
Yes.
And it's a really interesting part because she is stronger, smarter, tougher, more experienced than him, and mostly only with her tutelage can you know, jerky Tom Cruise become Tom Cruise action hero world saving movie star.
Right.
It's an interesting subversion of that stereotype.
Exactly. And it's a really interesting, I would argue, it's a masterful performance from Cruise because he's addressing his own persona throughout the entire thing and manipulating it and kind of playing with it, all those personae that we know him from. And it's just this wonderful kind of, you get every Tom Cruise in this movie. And it's a very smart, self-aware performance on his part.
I'm reading here, though, a critique that says, yes, but, and the yes, but here is, yes, you've got this strong woman character in Emily Blunt, but it's the female Yoda phenomenon, they're saying. This is from The Week, and they write, a seasoned warrior who has the knowledge and skill to transform the ineffectual every man into a heroic savior. She's smart, competent, tough. At her most mundane, she teaches the hero about responsibility and maturity, as in knocked up. At her most powerful, she'll use her countless skills to make the male hero into a fighter like herself, Matrix, or here, Edge of Tomorrow. But here, this critic says the female Yoda has become the new normal because it allows Hollywood to appeal to feminist concerns while continuing to feed male wish fulfillment. What do you say, Anne?
I think that's a fascinating reading, and it reminds me very much of the trope of the magical Negro, you know, that I've been aware of and writing about for years, too. I mean, I think that that's a valid, I think it's always valid to point that out.
When Morgan Freeman walks in out of the fog
right.
and makes everything magically
there, right.
Right.
Exactly, to kind of to just bolster
guy.
Up and yeah.
I would say the difference, though, between that critique and the sort of magic Negro critique is that right now, what we're talking about with this change of the landscape gender-wise at the movies is that it's just part of this larger upheaval in the cultural landscape. And that wasn't true. That's not true with black people in movies the way it is with women right now. It's not just the movies where amazing, interesting, exciting, promising things are happening. It's happening on TV as well. There's a lot of really interesting literary and book conversations centered around the question of gender and representation and who gets to say what. And I think that on TV especially, I think that is where the Bridesmaids effect has gone and has allowed this diversity of types of women to exist both on television and in the movies. And it takes the pressure off someone like Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow having to represent all women. And it's sort of the landscape around a part like that just allows it to function in a much different way than it would have maybe 10 years ago when all you had were these quote female Terminator parts, and you were starting to throw up your hands and ask, well, what else can women do besides be Linda Hamilton? Well, that's more than 10 years ago, but I mean that Linda Hamilton Sigourney Weaver trope sort of lasts through the movies, and it's still there. But I think that there's just now more options in terms of representations of women in movies.
And a lot of
bad
people
and good.
Thinking and talking about it, this was just last week. Here was Kerry Washington giving her acceptance speech at an Award for Excellence in Television at the Women in Film Los Angeles Gala. Here talking about the importance of women in film community, the economic benefit and more of women. Kerry Washington saying, stepping up.
When we step up for ourselves, We create opportunity, whether it's because we inspire other people or we employ other people, or both.
And of course, she's been out there big in scandal. Let's go to our listeners, Janet in Auburn, Alabama. Janet, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment.
Yeah.
As a strong woman and a mother of four grown strong women daughters,
kudos.
That this is very welcoming to see, of course, more women's wisdom and sensitivity into films and into films that celebrate the part of a woman, the intelligence, strength, resourcefulness, and how they can support one another, and there's less, maybe in a sense, competitiveness. These all may be stereotypes that are wrong, but I do not feel that women are helped, and I don't even know if I like that word. The idea of women being equal is supported at all when the roles only focus on being like as sexually shallow and irresponsible as men have always been. And when this is a part of, or a big part of shows, movies and shows, I just think that actually detracts from what women should be trying to do. And I have not seen any of those, the movies in that have been talked about, but
no.
I am in the process of reading The Problem with Our Stars or whatever.
The
that
Fault
is,
in Our Stars. Fault, problem. But Janet, let us pick it up, and Anne, I'll bring it to you. What about sexuality and its portrayal? If Hollywood is at whatever glacial pace, if it's changing right now, what about sexuality? And Janet's, you know, pointing there with some interest but concern.
Oh, I think that's a fascinating point. I mean, I almost have to sit and sort of process that, like, because I take her point. You know, I think, which is back to circling back to what Wesley said. You know, it gets to this issue of the monoculture. That's the word I keep using. But what we want is just more diversity in every shape and form, so that we're not just getting the same stories and the same behaviors, only, you know, we'll make it a woman, or we'll, you know, insert, you know, type mm-hmm. A here. And I just think that that really speaks to the necessity. And this gets to these studies that keep coming out year after year, that even though we might see representations of women changing and maybe increasing and becoming more diverse on screen, when it comes to the people that are generating those images and generating those stories, those numbers tend to stay static and low. And I just read a story the other day about a group of female playwrights that have concocted a list of excellent plays by women that they are bringing to theaters around the country to say, look, here are some excellent plays that you can be producing. And I'm wondering if that some, you know, a similar initiative could start in Hollywood regarding screenplays in terms of just new stories, you know, just new stories, fresh stories to tell.
I mean, one of those that you raise is Obvious Child. We've got a little scene here. It touches on sexuality in a way. Maybe we jump off from it. Here where Donna, played by Jenny Slate in the indie film Obvious Child, practices a conversation in front of the mirror, kind of, with her one-night stand, Max. She has to tell him, he's played by Jack Lacey, that she's having an abortion. She's rehearsing how she might convey this.
Hey, Max. Remember from before when we did sex to each other?
I can't get your blouse off.
I'm having your abortion. Do you want to share a dessert? Leave with that. Definitely leave with that. Perfect. The cross
is in the ball. Okay. There's a woman's perspective, a one-night stand and then an abortion. It's a tough story to begin with. I'm not sure it's going to make our caller from Alabama really thrilled, but it's definitely a woman working through this conversation, Anne.
Definitely. And I think, you know, even though she might engage in feckless behavior, she sure is grappling honestly with the consequences. I mean, it's not consequence free. And even though there's a lot of humor in it, and I mean, humor that really just absolutely goes right up to the line. And I think in a couple of cases really crosses the line in terms of, I mean, my breath was taken away at a couple of these of the jokes. It's incredibly confrontational in terms of just being honest about women's, you know, so many women's experience. So, you know, you can have your feelings about the behavior, and you can have feelings about her choice, but you cannot accuse this movie of eliding anything or obscuring or dodging. It's very, very confrontational.
Melissa in Boston, thanks for calling, Melissa. You're on the air.
I would just like to see more. It's just a comment. More movies with positive messages for women and teens in general, because, you know, most of the women that are portrayed now is very shallow, just ready to have sex at any point. And so this creates a lot of pressure on teens, you know, and I would love to see just more positive messages.
Melissa, I appreciate your call. And this is the point that you had gone to before your recent column here, and you went to it pretty hard. You were writing about Elliot Rodger, the young man who ended up killing, became a mass murderer, really, out in the Santa Barbara area, that we all saw that story. And you wrote in a controversial column, he unwittingly expressed the toxic double helix of insecurity and entitlement that comprises Hollywood's DNA. You wrote, for generations, mass entertainment has been overwhelmingly controlled by white men whose escapist fantasies so often revolve around vigilantism and sexual wish fulfillment, often if not always featuring a steady through line of casual misogyny. Rogers' rampage may be a function of his own profound distress. You acknowledge his mental illness, but it also shows, you wrote, how a sexist movie monoculture can be toxic for women and men alike. That got a heavy feedback from people who didn't go for that. Seth Rogen and more saying, wait a minute. But you're standing by your perspective there, Anne.
I am. I mean, I think what I was trying to do, and I want to make sure that it's clear that the context of that column was the video that he had posted, because it was what was so startling about the video, for lack of a better term, were its production values. I mean, it just had this incredible cinematic quality.
It was from a Hollywood family. His dad in the biz.
Right. So I think that's why else would a film, you know, otherwise I would have nothing to say or I wouldn't have anything to publish necessarily on the issue. But I was really focusing in on that video.
And this is where he's vowing revenge on women who rejected him, other men having more fun and sex while he was rotting in loneliness, he's saying there.
Yes. And so that was the context of the column, was looking at that short piece on YouTube and reflecting on what it reflected, you know, just thinking about what it reflected about the cinematic culture that it itself seemed to be a product of. So yes, I am, and I do think that films have power. I mean, I think that they do help. They certainly don't reflect real life, quote unquote, but they help shape what we expect from it. And I don't know that that's so controversial, but.
Wesley, how about a toxic double helix of insecurity and entitlement for men that comprises Hollywood's DNA? Do you see it there, sir?
I mean, I do. I agree that there is something there culturally in terms of. I mean, I'm a little. I thought it was brave of Anne to go to that place because, you know, that video was tough because what wound up happening as a result of it was people sort of extrapolating about what it portends for women versus men, and. It's interesting. I think it's a good thing to sort of take a step back and think about the roots of a video like that and where it comes from. And it didn't, you know, it didn't come from thin air. And I think Anne picked up on she had her finger on the pulse of something. And that was maybe one of the more disturbing things about that. But I mean, something like this happens. I mean, I hate to say once a year, but once a year, there's always some flashpoint that ignites a gender debate about how women are treated by men and how women are perceived to be treated by men and how men perceive that perception.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women, power, and female presence in Hollywood and in the movies. They've been second fiddle for a long time, and we're asking, is that changing right now? Of course, yes, we can look at Obvious Child and Maleficent and The Fault in Our Stars and more, but there's plenty of other out there. Here's Hercules coming out next month, stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson, title role. It's old school, fighting shirtless, enormous bears and lions with his bare hands.
Are you only the legend, or are you the truth? Behind the legend. Now, tell me, who are you?
He's Hercules. You can hear it. But we can look in other directions. Meryl Streep has talked about women in film and box office for a long time. Cate Blanchett kind of maybe taken over some of that role as the most outspoken feminist in Hollywood. Earlier this month at the Women in Film Los Angeles Gala, she won the Crystal Award for Excellence in Film and talked about it.
There's stones that still need to be turned over by women. There's a lot of things, a lot of doors that still need to be opened. Not because women don't have the ability, but simply because there's a lack of imagination. You know, there's certain inroads that have been made and that certain pathways that have been trod. And I think that women are saying, well, why does it have to be done that way?
Ann Hornaday is with us, Washington Post film critic. Her recent column headline, The Sisters of Summer. She's talking this summer. Wesley Morris is with us from Grantland, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic. His headline recently, summer movie preview, same dudes, more women. I want to talk to a couple of directors who are in the swim and with us right now from Los Angeles. We're very happy to have with us Gina Prince-Bythewood, American film director and writer, director of Love and Basketball, The Secret Life of Bees, the forthcoming Blackbird out in November. Gina Prince-Bythewood, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Tom.
And from Los Angeles, Gren Wells is here, writer and director making a directorial debut with The Road Within, coming out right around now, named one of Variety's 10 directors to watch in 2014. Gren Wells, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Gina, you've been at this for a while. Do you feel progress, something changing, moving, more range for you as a woman working in Hollywood as the years slowly tick by?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, there obviously has been a lot of talk throughout the years of the lack of female directors, and it's something that, you know, never seems to change year by year. I mean, maybe one or two are added. But I've felt that it's not so much the female director is discriminated against because, you know, again, as I often say, and it's true, talent has no gender, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be more female directors. And I have to wonder, is it more because of our choices, and is it our choices that are being discriminated against, and that we tend to gravitate towards making films that reflect us and make films that star women and tell a story from a female point of view? And I'm really coming to find that that is more of the situation.
Your choices, women's choices in terms of the kinds of stories that they want to tell, you're saying that those themselves being at some level rejected, Gina?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a perception in Hollywood that a female lead in a film is not going to sell, and that is a constant mantra that we hear. Cate Blanchett spoke on that and really pointed to the inaccuracies of that. And you can look at the box office and see that that's not true. But it is a myth that's constantly perpetuated. I know as a filmmaker, I want to make all sorts of films. But first and foremost, you know, I want to go see movies with females in the lead and tell our stories. And those are the kind of films I want to make as well.
Gren, you're just getting into the game at some level with your directorial debut with The Road Within here, young end of the female writing and directing world. When you look out on this landscape, does it look hostile? Does it look promising? I mean, as a woman, do you think, well, this is welcoming to me now, or I have to fight my way in?
Well, I've been writing professionally for 14 years, So I have been dealing with it just from a little bit of a different angle. And, you know, I've gotten jobs because I'm a woman. I've lost jobs because I'm a woman. And so I just think you just have to do the work. And I really don't look at it in a pessimistic nature. I know that I have a valid viewpoint, and especially after this film, I think people are going to see that. And, I agree with Gina. Talent has no gender.
We know The Secret Life of Bees and more from Gina. Tell us about The Road Within. What's the story, Gren?
It's about a young man with Tourette's who, at the beginning of the film, his mother, who was his primary caregiver, dies. So his estranged father is forced to step in, but he's running for political office and does not want his son on the campaign trail. So he puts him into a clinic that's run by a very experimental doctor, And once there, he falls in love with a young anorexic girl. And together, they decide to steal the doctor's car, but end up having to kidnap his OCD roommate when he threatens to tell on them. And so with the dad and the doctor in hot pursuit, the three kids go on this life-changing road trip to go deliver the ashes of his mother to the ocean.
Here's just a little bit from The Road Within. Marie, played by Zoe Kravitz, asking Vincent, played by Robert Sheehan, about having Tourette's syndrome.
So do you know when you're going to spasm? What's it feel like?
It builds, like when you have to sneeze.
Can you make it stop?
Well, can you stop yourself from sneezing?
Good point.
Maybe. There's a woman's sensitivity, insight right there. Gina, it was called Blackbird. Now it's Beyond the Lights, retitled, coming out in November. What do you have on tap for us? What's coming in this film, Gina?
I'm very excited about this film, and it's about a young singer raised by a single mother who realizes early on that her daughter has talent. And knowing what is popular in R&B and hip-hop, she pushes her daughter into a hyper-sexualized persona to get noticed, and it works, and she becomes a success at that. And it's really, though, about at the expense of her soul and how she tries to fight against this persona and become the artist that she wants to be.
Is it kind of a Donna Summers story with that?
I would say it's definitely a reflection of what is happening, mm-hmm. Not just in hip-hop and R&B now when you see what's going on with Miley Cyrus, but it's a constant cycle of female artists, both in music and I think in the arts as well, of sexuality sells. And we've gotten to the point really where people are pushing it so far that, you know, the envelope, there's no
envelope,
go but over a cliff. And that's really where our character is at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, well, that's hot and relevant and gender relevant. Wesley Morris, what about the numbers here in terms of writers at work in Hollywood today, directors, in terms of box office? What message do the numbers tell us, Wesley?
Well, I mean, the fact of the myth is true, that this perception that women can't star in things that don't make money is false. There was a big report by Walter Hickey over at 538 based around the various permutations of the Bechdel test, which is that Alison Bechdel cartoon, or one of her drawings, in which she basically laid out the parameters of what constitutes a legitimate women's film. And those things aren't true. But if you then sort of conversely look at the numbers of people who have access to make movies and tell stories, those numbers are depressing. In 2013, according to a study, Women's Media Center study, I believe that of the 250 highest grossing movies, 6% of those were directed by women. In television, across various roles, I think the highest percentage of women in any particular division is 38%. The numbers aren't reflective of the culture itself, and they haven't really changed very much in the last 20 years, according to that report. So the question really is, I mean, as excited as I am about the women in these summer movies, the 17 of the 40 films being significantly fronted by or having participation by women in them, only one of them is directed by a woman, and that's Lana Wachowski, who made Jupiter Rising with her brother Andy. So, you know, I mean, this I've been very hesitant to get overjoyed about this. It's exciting that these movies with women in them are hits so far, but I mean, there's still a long way to go in terms of the infrastructure itself changing enough to have us not have to have these segments on radio shows.
And Lana Wachowski, formerly Lawrence, who with her brother, then male, earned her sort of stripes as a male.
Yeah.
Right. And I would also add, I mean, I think Gina is a great example. I mean, she's made two really highly regarded films, mm-hmm. Love and Basketball and The Secret Life of Bees, which mm-hmm. did quite well. Mm-hmm. And what I would like to see, and I don't know that there are statistics about this, but I would love to, you know, on the basis of that, she should be, you know, they should be beating a path to her door. And I'm wondering if one of the bottlenecks is first time, second time women directors getting the chances that they're male colleagues do, you know, in terms of getting projects sent to them. And I mean, I feel that women do have a harder time, even when they make really good first and second movies. They're just not offered the same diversity of projects, and they're not on those short lists.
Gina, what are you thinking when you are up against that? When you hear that 6% of the top 250, you know, big grossing films from women, what are you thinking about? Why?
I mean, it really is it's incomprehensible, that number. It just doesn't make sense. And you know, to touch on what Anne said, I've been very fortunate, honestly, to be offered, you know, a number of projects. My issue is that I'm a control freak and I want to write and direct what I do. And so it's really about taking the time to write those scripts myself. And sadly, I'm a slow writer, but my issue of the amount of time in between projects is really the time it takes to get things set up. And again, this project, Beyond the Lights, it took 4 years, which, again, is mind-boggling to me. But the, you know, why we're filmmakers, this is a story about this woman that I really needed to tell, and you have to be passionate about what you're doing because it is a constant fight to overcome no. And I got no's from every single studio in trying to make this.
Maybe man just let it rip. your care maybe slightly in the way. I don't know. Jennifer in New Haven, Connecticut. Jennifer, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I want to express some concern about some of your previous caller statements where they were saying that they want to see more women in film making better sexual choices. And the point I wanted to make is that any choice that a woman makes for herself in film is a responsible choice. She is empowering her own sexuality, and I think that's important.
Fair point, and made with strength over time. Gina, I wonder what you say in response to that when the character in your upcoming film, Beyond the Lights, is struggling with a kind of sexuality, but I don't know if it's imposed by the marketplace rather than necessarily a personal choice.
No, the call is very interesting, and I do want to touch on it by a quick story in terms of Love and Basketball and why it's important to have female directors. And that is, you know, within that film, the female character loses her virginity in the film to the boy that she's in love with, and it's her first time, and shot the scene. And the note I got back from the studio and the male execs is that they wanted me to reshoot it because she didn't look like she was enjoying it enough. And, you know, for me, it was of course, I fought against that and was very blunt with them and, you know, hate to break the fantasy, but the first time is not great.
It's scary.
And it is scary. And that's exactly what I wanted to reflect. And it was a fight to be able to maintain that truth. And, you know, with Beyond the Lights, again, this film, again, touching on this hypersexuality that has become normal for girls. I mean, there really is an assault right now about what it means to be sexual and how much you should show and what part of yourself do you really own. And it's just really important that we put this film out there and try and change that conversation.
Anne Hornaday, that kind of nuance that Gina was determined to show there in Love and Basketball with a young woman losing her virginity and how that's depicted, I mean, that's exactly the kind of framing of life that you're writing about in your recent
right.
column. This is how we understand what life is, how it works, and
right.
a nuance brought to it by Gina as a woman director.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, another term for what I'm talking about is the male gaze. And I would... You're exactly right. I mean, that exactly gets to what I was trying to get at in that column, which is that double helix of entitlement and
male insecurity.
Those sorts of notes, yeah, insecurity and entitlement, those sorts of notes from executives, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at, is that it's all conditioned. You know, so much of what we see is conditioned by that. And kudos to Gina for maintaining control of her stories. I mean, I just think that's heroic.
But one way or another, a narrative is imposed on life. It becomes an expectation of life. Wesley?
I just wanted you, when Gina was explaining what had taken her, she works slowly. And Tom, you had sort of picked up on, you had said something, and I know what you meant when you said it. But I think it's a question worth asking about women's choices in terms of the care and time and craftsmanship they want to put into their work, because in some ways I wonder if there's a pressure to do the best job you possibly can, because who knows whether you'll get to do it again.
Yeah.
And whether there's some sort of corollary for a woman who just wants to make crap the way men just go out and make crap.
I mean, Cate Blanchett in that same speech was talking about the importance of women being able to fail and the kind of freedom to maybe let it rip that would suggest. Well, what do you think, Wesley?
Yes, I do believe. I mean, I think it's just important for women to not succeed in the marketplace, just as long as there's a variety of women out there doing things. I mean, it can't all work, but as long as, you know, the tide is rising and everybody sort of hopefully rises with it. But
we hope for that. Wesley, we're up against the clock. Wesley Morris and Hornaday, Gina Prince-Bythewood. Look for Beyond the Lights. Gren Wells, look for The Road Within. Thanks to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.